Right, we've had a momentary power failure at the press conference. We'll be back on in a moment.
I believe we're back now. It's a little chaos before they're trying to get themselves organized. We're hoping to get to...
The POW camp that we visited was one that was not the Hilton one in the middle of town, but was outside of town. And we met with, as Telford said, about 13 prisoners. And they were completely shocked. And what I was just mentioning was the irony of having pilots say to us, well, what's going on? I mean, I don't understand what's happening, because their roofs had caved in and they were trying to build themselves somewhere to hide out in their own, you know, bunk rooms. And they just absolutely, like, you know, like most of the world, had kind of falsely hoped that possibly there was going to be an end to the bombing, and that the things were going to be signed and treaty signed, and they would be home possibly by Christmas, and then all of a sudden, kabam.
You know, were there any injuries among the POWs?
Yes, sir. When we were there, there had not been injuries, but there were hunks of shrapnel that they were showing us that had come through their windows and through the ceilings, and then we didn't witness any of it, but were told that several POWs were injured within the next two nights of raids.
Well, we better say who told us.
Okay.
I think we got the first word about the injuries from a curious route. It was the day that we went to see the religious leaders, and the leader of the Protestant group told us that he had been in the habit of conducting a Christmas service at the POW camp. He was not going to be able to do it this year because several of them had been injured, including the harmonium player who'd injured his hand and couldn't play the harmonium. This came unsolicited from him, and then I think the following day, some of the French journalists went out and saw the same camp, and they told us that they had observed there that there were several injuries, but no one had been seriously injured.
Barry, could I bring you in on the discussion for a minute? You fought the Irish Cal Division in the South the first time you saw news in North Vietnam. Tell us a little bit about what sort of reaction you had.
This is Barry Romo.
It's really unbelievable. When you consider the fact first that I fought with the Maricel Division, which has an infamous history. When I got to Vietnam, the people treated me like a brother. The people were kind, they were generous, they were gentle. Every place I went, people smiled. They asked for Vietnam Veteran Against the War buttons. They were very considerate about where they took us and what they showed us. For instance, they did not take us to see shot down B-52s. Because they said that would embarrass us, and everybody needs to have some pride. Unbelievable. You can't go into describing how people treat you after you've killed them for a year, and then you come back to say it should have ended a long time ago.
Did any of you see any American planes down? Do you think that if you would ask to see them, they would have let you?
Well, actually, on Thursday morning, after we saw the Con Tin district, the journalists were taken to see a B-52 that had crashed in one of the Hanoi streets. But the people with us instructed our drivers not to take us there. And I complained, and I said I wanted to see the B-52. And the Mr. Quat said I didn't think that you would want to see that. And then he tried to arrange it, but by that time the B-52 had been dragged out of the street for perfectly obvious reasons.
To your knowledge, either in letters or in the contacts that you made personally with POWs, have you uncovered any new prisoners that we didn't know were there before? Any people who were missing in action or that we simply didn't know?
No.
This is the first time that the PRG has admitted to holding American prisoners in South Vietnam.
No, it isn't.
It's not.
No, it's not true.
The first time mail has come through.
No, that's not true.
When were letters
last time was?
Somebody from the Committee of Liaison could supply that information. I don't know it.
No,
I'm
sorry.
Where do you go from this experience now?
I'm not sure yet. I'd like
California,
to go home.
California,
go home and see my son this evening, and then try to figure out what's the best course of action to take. The one other thing I was left very impressed with is that the people put a lot of confidence in the American people. I mean, aside from just being really sweet and unbelievably kind to us, they keep asking about what's the response going to be and what are the Americans going to do. And so my job simply continues the way it was before, only with a little more intensity of trying to wake up a very sleepy public.
Let's go back to the
Can we let the woman ask the question?
Do you have any indication?
It's a dirty trick, I know.
You said you were treated very nicely, very politely, you saw all the spirits. Do you have any indication that this was done just because you are who you are?
Who, the four of us?
Yes.
Meaning what? Americans?
Your sympathies.
Well, we wouldn't be in there if we weren't considered brothers. I mean, even though there was much diversity among the way the four of us felt, we would not have ever been allowed in there in the first place if we weren't considered friends.
Well, I think it's important along that we took walks separate from the interpreters and the people who were with us. We would just walk the streets of Hanoi and smile at the children and talk to people.
And they'd point at his little button and ask for buttons.
We never got any bad words, any bad looks. And that was from everybody. That was a civilian population.
Well, along that same consideration.
No.
When walking through that district, it was absolutely totally demolished. And after, you know, passing bits of flesh here, an hysterical woman there, the old woman singing, "Where is my son? Where is my son?" Met an old man coming my direction who could not possibly have known any of us from Adam. And he was, see, there was no way to walk. Everybody was carrying their bicycles, you know, and sort of carrying each other somewhat,
or Eve, excuse me.
I'm awfully progressive of you.
That was Telford Taylor. Correct.
So anyway, this old man was stumbling and almost falling in the rubble, so I reached out my hand to him, and he looked at me. He had this fantastic face. I mean, just a grand old face and a white beard, and his face was terribly distressed. And we held hands for a minute and looked at each other, and his eyes filled up, and then he muttered some stuff in Vietnamese, and then he said, danke schön, which was the one word, way he knew to communicate, and he was thanking me.
Do you think it's possible that the North Vietnamese might have considered the fact that you would hold a press conference when I get back, and might have given you consideration because of that? You are getting a considerable amount of publicity out of your trip, and I think you expected it.
I think we had almost, we wouldn't have had half as much publicity unless if the United States Air Force hadn't come to our aid as far as publicity goes.
Yeah, I want to comment on that. Look, we were part of, to all intents and purposes, part of an international community there. We all spent a great deal of time with the French journalists. I think we were treated in about the same way that everybody else in the press and diplomatic corps there are treated. That is to say, everybody was treated very courteously and very well.
Anyone who might have access to America, see, the point, of course, is we didn't know the United States Air Force was coming to your aid prior to your coming to this press conference.
Neither did we.
We were here before they were there.
Well, yeah, I have a slight idea what you're trying to get at, but let me just respond again by saying,
perhaps it's possible that you might have been you. That's the only question.
God only knows, and if so, so what?
If they're using it to try to end the war, that's fine.
Look, I think it's important to get a kind of a picture of who's there. There's an International Control Commission group made up of Canadians, Poles, and Indians. There's an Egyptian embassy, a Cuban embassy, Swedes. There are French press there. There's Pravda, all sorts and varieties of people. Nobody there was restricted or controlled. Towards the end, it got, the Vietnamese kind of insisted on going with us on walks because they knew where the bomb shelters were. And they were kind of nervous. And I rather appreciated having a guy next to me who could tell me where to duck if the time came.
How often did you have to duck during your tour?
Well, I think that we made a rough count that we were about 55 raids while we were there.
What was it like during the raid? What would happen? Baez,
well, the scariest thing for me was in the middle of the night, in Hanoi there are mosquito nets around the beds, and I went to bed fully clothed. My one sort of condescension towards American life was to take my shoes off. and I put my shoes by my bed, and in the middle of the night, one of two things happened. Either the bombs would start falling, and then the siren, or the siren and then the bombs. But to be lying in bed, fully clothed, half asleep or asleep, and suddenly, boom, outside the window,
be caught in a mosquito net.
Fight your way through the mosquito net, and I try to find my shoes, and then I had my coat laid out with matches and stuff. I'd light matches as I staggered down the hall to find the bomb shelter.
Did the bed shake and everything? The whole room?
Oh, yeah.
How long would the raid last? How long would the bombs keep falling?
Half an hour to an hour.
How do you all feel about the stop and bombing now? How does this strike?
Well, I think I made some comment on that initially. Again, undertaking to speak for all four of us without having discussed it, I assume that we're all enormously gratified that the death and suffering we saw where we were has come to an end. But this, for the time being at least, but this is only part of the picture. All four of us, whatever we may disagree on other things, are all opposed to America's policy and involvement in the war. The war is still going on. The bombing south of 20th parallel hasn't been announced to be stopped. We hope that process has begun will be completed.
Aside from Mr. Elworth's question, an obvious boost to the morale of the North Vietnamese by virtue of all the coverage you're getting now that you're back, what do you feel that your trip accomplished? What was the one big accomplishment of this trip?
The immediate purpose was, as I've described it, I've tried to cover this in what we said at the outset. I think the greatest accomplishment has been the opportunity to observe and report. Speaking for myself, I've tried to keep what I've said, and I propose to in the future keep it as confined as I can to what I myself have seen and heard. That's the only way to do it. I did read in the newspaper some comment from a Washington source, a governmental source, that we were not to be trusted because we are an escorted group, to which I would have to reply that until the Pentagon can find some way to get an unescorted group in there, they'll have to put up with what they've got. Escorted we were. Of course, that's true. And that might mean that we didn't see some things that we would like to have seen, but it doesn't mean that we didn't see what we did see. And what we saw is quite sufficient to make the basis of a substantive and useful assessment of the consequences of what we're doing there.
I wrote a letter to the trustees of Berkeley Divinity School when I left, saying that I personally felt called to share, I guess I said, in the great and horrible experience of our time. And that's exactly what happened. And I think it's important that there be some of us who have shared in that experience and then can talk about it to anybody who cares to listen.
Thank you very much.
One thing, we've got one letter for the family of
could you hold on
Edward Miller.
A group of reporters is crowding around the table with a delegation. And I think what's going to happen now is that the reporters from the press are going to more or less pounce on these people and try to interview them privately or together. In fact, that's what's happening. You've been listening to a press conference with four Americans just recently returned from Hanoi after living through the just about the entire American bombing raid of the last 2 weeks. So Barry Romo, a veteran of the AmeriCal Division and a member of Vietnam Veterans Against the War, Professor Telford Taylor of the Columbia University Law School, the chief American counsel at the Nuremberg trials in the 1940s, Joan Baez, a folk singer and pacifist, and Michael Allen, dean of the Berkeley Divinity School in New Haven and associate dean of the Yale Divinity School. They arrived, incidentally, last night in Philadelphia, almost this same group of reporters and photographers and cameramen and so forth was prepared to meet them at Kennedy Airport last night. After about a two-hour wait, their flight was diverted to Philadelphia. The reason given was because of the fog. Of all the planes that were having trouble landing, theirs was the first to be diverted to another city. But we don't have any indication that that's anything out of the ordinary for sure. We're hoping to get a chance to talk with these four people. Ideally, I'd like to invite them up to the studios and let you talk to them as well. But I, at this point, can't promise anything. Things are very chaotic here, and it's impossible, I think, at this point for me to get any of them over here. I think we'll stay here another couple of minutes, and maybe we'll be able to at least speak to Joan Baez, who's leaving tonight, California, she said. We're coming to you live from the office of the Committee of Liaison with Families of Americans Detained in Vietnam. The office is located at 9th Avenue and 42nd Street. It's WBAI in New York City. And you can hear what's going on in the background here. It's not terribly conducive for anything. Maybe what we should do is go back to the studio, and if I can manage to get Joan Baez over here for a couple of minutes, I'll get back in touch with you, Gary, and maybe we can cut away back here again, okay?
Okay, fine, Bruce. So we'll talk to you as soon as you have any further developments. This is WBAI, listener-sponsored radio in New York City at 99.5 FM.
Be not too hard, for life is short, and nothing is given to man. Be not too hard when his soul is bought, for he must manage as best he can. Be not too hard.
Do you feel in any way basically changed by what you've been through in Vietnam?
Well, I hope so. If not, that means that I went through it all with my blinders on, and I don't think that happened. It's hard to tell, you know, what will emerge from this series of bombardments of emotions, you know, that took place. But I'm hoping that aside from renewed energies, and obviously if you sit through something like that for 11 days, something's bound to be either born or reborn in you. Yeah.
Somebody asked me last night whether the might be possible that, that your own vision of nonviolence as a way of life might have been changed by this experience.
I mean, it certainly is put to a test in a situation like that. I mean, sitting in a bomb shelter when you hear anti-aircraft guns go off, you have to admit to a very human feeling of relief that it's just that instead of the sound of a bombing. On the other hand, walking through that those craters of a sort of a moon surface that was left of a marketplace with people, some people wailing, and most people, you know, not crying, not giving in to crying and all that, and we just passed a piece of body lying in the brick, and the French communist newspaperman came up to me. He had argued with me for days on exactly that subject. He said, well, all right, now, what about the guns? How do you feel about the guns now? And what I wanted to say to him was, look, you stupid ass, you know, what do you think got us here? It was man's addiction to solving his problems that way. But at the same time, I knew what he was saying was, you know, aren't you relieved that the SAM-3s are blowing down the, you know, or shooting down the B-52s? And there are very human feelings in me mixed about that, but at the same time, I see it all as a continue. Like for Vietnam, I mean, I love the people of Vietnam, and I can't stand the slogans about Vietnam. I mean, to create one more nation state, to me, is distasteful. And yet, it brought it into a very, very real situation for me to be sitting in a bomb shelter, knowing these absolutely, totally defenseless peasants were being bombed. I still don't see any cure for the general situation out of bringing, you know, Russian weapons and Chinese weapons and versus American weapons, you know.
Were you able to talk to individual Vietnamese who you just met at random on the street? Was there an interpreter with you who could facilitate that kind of discussion?
There was. They're usually very shy, and they just smile. And the kids always laugh. They just have hysterics. They look at you, and they burst out laughing, and you kid. And what I did was I took a little tape recorder with me, and I would go up to, well, I'd start off with two kids, and pretty soon there'd be like 30 or 40 or even 50. And what I do is I record them just saying maybe two sentences, and you play it back, and they burst out laughing. So you record the laughing, and then eventually you just have this crazy, you know, hysterical laughing, and I've got, you know, little hunks of tape doing that. And then the one thing that stands out where it was kind of a chance happening was the first bombing that we saw, and a girl came by carrying her bicycle because the road was bombed out. She looked in the car window, and she said something in Vietnamese, and the interpreter kind of nodded, and I said, what did she say? And he said, she says, oh, they've come out to get a look at Nixon's piece. So things like that would be interpreted to us.
Were you an object of curiosity because you're white, you and the other three? Because you're white.
Well, what we were told was that the people knew who we were because they knew that there were four American peace people, which is, you know, how they thought of us, meaning that we were in solidarity with them. And so they apparently knew who we were when we walked on the streets, but they're just, it's just the opposite culture from one like this. Nobody comes up and says anything or, you know, asks for an autograph. They would come up and shake the hand of the interpreter, you know, and nod, and then nod at us, and we'd all smile at each other. But for the most part, you'd feel as though nobody even noticed that you were there.
How did they, I'm interested primarily in the people who weren't officials and weren't in positions of authority, how did they interpret what was happening, and what did they feel Nixon's intention was in creating the bombing raids?
I think that what happens kind of is that, like, all the people on the committee who were our interpreters and things, had to get busy, you know, getting their families out of the town and getting their children to places that they thought would be safe, or shifting them around to where they didn't think it was going to be bombed next. And the energy seems to go into, like, when we left, we said, well, what are you going to do now? Because they were still bombing when we left. In fact, as we took off, they were bombing. The energy goes in. We said, you know, are you going to take any kind of rest or anything? He says, oh, no, you know, the 200 people dying every day, you don't rest. And so there was not as much conjecture on what was happening in Washington and Paris as there was on trying to take care of the people who were being blown all over the marketplace. You know?
Another thing I wanted to ask you about is, how are the Vietnamese prepared to deal with the bombing in terms of shelter and medical care? I heard an air raid siren here the other day and had that instant flash of what would happen if a plane came over here and nobody would know what to do. What do they do?
There's a hole in the sidewalk, I mean, like a little tank kind of thing, shelter that two people can jump into. And that on most streets, there's in the middle of the city, about every 4 or 5 yards, there's this little tiny shelter like that. Then in all of the parks, there are shelters that are mounds with a little door, and you go down inside. I was never inside one of those, so I don't know how large it is. All the hotels, I mean, everything, every house everywhere has, it's just a part of it. It's like, you know, the way we would have a bathroom or two, they have a shelter or two. And the tragic part is the part outside the city when you can't hear the air raid. I mean, it's very loud when you're in the center of the city. And believe me, getting caught in that mosquito net, you know, it's really, in a way, it's very funny. And by the end, you start laughing, you know, because you get it'd be a very inglorious way to die, be wrapped up in your mosquito net when you couldn't make it out of the shelter. But the people who can't hear the warning and are, you know, get waked up late at night and are on their way to try to find a shelter, and then that's it, and they can't make it, which is the old people and the kids.
How about medical care?
Medical care, they need certain things. Wow, if you really technically want to find out, ask Mike, because he has a list. They need transfusion stuff, and they need plasma, and there are a couple of other things that they really are short on. And medical aid to Indochina is the best way to go through that.
We heard that when the hospital is bombed, they were prepared to move the patients out to other locations.
There were 7 people killed out of a hospital that had 1,000 beds, which shows you how well prepared they are. They got them underground, there were more people, because when we got there, they were trying to hoist hunks of concrete up to get some people who were trapped. By the time they got them out, it was 2 days later, and I think they were all dead, so that was 20 people. But they were mainly hospital workers. They weren't the patients. And so the hospital, I assume, is very well prepared, because that place was devastated. I mean, there was nothing, absolutely nothing, but trees and rubble and a few walls. And it was huge. I mean, the director was was sort of in shock. I mean, he was showing us around as though he were showing us like his hospital, something he was proud of. But instead of saying this is, he's saying this was. You know, I gave up about halfway through that one and sat. And they were so considerate of me, because I would lose all the color in my face, and they'd say, "You stay here," because they'd smell, you know, smells they knew I probably couldn't handle very well.
Did you spend much time in the shelters?
Yeah, I spent a lot of time in the shelters, and I, at first, it was a feeling of security being in there, you know, and then after you've seen what can happen to a shelter with a direct hit, then you feel a little less secure. And then the very last night, with the help of Barry, who was really lovely, I mean, and literally did make up all this bullshit for me so that I would think that I was safe, you know, but I got fed up with running down to the shelter, so I stayed on the third floor, which is where the Agence France-Presse was. And I stood out in the balcony, and there was, during the alert, and the lights all went out, and we waited for the bombing. And I stood out there, and Barry says, you know, if you really have courage, you'll sing. And so I started to sing, and at the end of each song, you hear little hands clapping in the shelters down on the streets. So I stayed out there the whole time. There was no bombing then. I mean, it was outside of the city, so there was nothing, no enormous test of strength. But it was a huge feeling of exhilaration not to have gone down into the shelter. Because in the shelter, I mean, there are so many hazards. One is a building falling on you, and you're in there. And that somehow is worse than just getting whapped, you know, just getting it done out on the rooftop somewhere. And so it's always a question. And, I mean, it was a very, very real question at that point. I stood out in the balcony and thought, what is it? I mean, what is it that I'm hanging on to? And the only real thing I could come up with was my son. I mean, I hated the thought of him not ever seeing me again and vice versa. And I thought, but he's really pretty well set up. He really loves his dad, and he's got a lot of good friends. And so, okay, what is it beyond that? I don't want to give up my life. And unlike every Vietnamese person I met, I was unready to give up my life. And so that's what it was all about. That's why you go down and hide in the shelter. And so it was a hefty night.
Are they, when you get on the ground, are they large? Are there lots and lots of people in there? Or?
Depends. The one that we spent most of the time in from our hotel was small. I mean, in other words, you go into it, and there are little benches kind of facing each other, and when you all sit down on the benches, when it's on a big night, you know, when it gets crowded, you're touching knees with the people right across from you. And what we would try to do is you grab a little piece of floor and put a pea coat and bring a blanket. And a couple nights, about 4 or 5 of us just stayed down the whole night because there were 10 raids. There's no sense in just going up and down and up and down. And then you try to sleep down there a little bit. And the other thing that I didn't like, but there's nothing you can do about it. Like our shelter said for foreign guests, you know, it was written in Vietnamese. And so then just an annex to it was where all the Vietnamese people came and sat, and it was chillier than ours. And eventually, when the nights got bad enough, they would infiltrate, you know, have to come in, and we'd start playing with their kids, anything to try to get them to forget that we were foreign, the little ones. And to come over, like, one of them played with my tape recorder until he practically wrecked it, you know, which was fine because I could finally hold the kid in my lap. They're really skittery. I mean, they'll giggle and laugh and everything, but they run away when you try to, you know, go up and pat them on the head or something. They split. So.
Did you bring music back with you? Did you make a lot of recordings?
What I did, I made tons of tapes, and I taped some of the, like, local musicians singing. Oh, they're really funny. Most of the popular songs are We Will March Together to the Front, and I was sitting there wincing as an old Christ, you know, if they only knew how I really feel about marching to the front. But they sang so beautifully. And some, oh, Jesus, the night that we thought, the second time we thought we were going to go the next day. I mean, we kept being delayed and delayed. But this woman came, and she had a beautiful, beautiful voice, and she sang Home Sweet Home.